Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Greetings and welcome to this next edition of the podcast for the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. I'm Ian McDuff, your host for the session and for the series. I am particularly happy to be welcoming Colin Rule, who's a dear friend and good colleague in the ODR field. For those of you in the ODR field, there's actually very little need for introduction because Colin's name is synonymous with ODR. In fact, you probably ought to rename the field in some way to include your name, Colin. Yeah, but modesty will stop you from doing that. Colin, you've been there since the outset. You've traced the whole pattern of the field as an innovator, creator of digital platforms, repository of the history and ethos of the field. You've been involved in the creation of automated online platforms for eBay, PayPal, and you bring to the field a combination of mediation practice, consultancy, academic teaching, research, critical thinking. And from what I know of you and what you've said of your background, a kind of humanitarian concern with this field too. So, you know, so long as that doesn't embarrass you too much to say that.
Not at all. I think that's something we share.
I hope so. I hope so, and more widely in the field. And it's something is worth remembering through these podcasts that we're actually, through the screens and the microphones, we are dealing with warm-blooded human beings. And some cold-blooded ones too, I imagine. Colin is the author of Online Dispute Resolution for Business from 2002, and more recently, The New Handshake, Online Dispute Resolution and the Future of Consumer Protection. Colin's day job, I think it's only one of your day jobs, and it is now as president and CEO of Mediate.com. More information can be seen at odr.info/fellows. So Colin, welcome.
Thank you so much, Ian. That was Colin, very gracious. I appreciate that kind introduction.
Well, good. And this chat reverses the usual form because normally you are the facilitator and the interviewer. So you're on the other side of the table.
I'm happy to have the magnifying glass turned on myself, but I can't think of anyone I'd rather have interview me than you. So thank you.
That's very, very kind. Well, I want to dive straight in without the usual sort of what is ODR and what's the field looking like, because we've done that in the last couple of sessions.
Sure.
And I want to dive straight into something that I know you're interested in, increasingly involved in, and something which is probably a mystery to most people out there. The metaverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And from the bit of preliminary reading I've been doing, the field has both enthusiasts and a degree of notoriety, and the meta part is linked with certain corporations as well. So I'd love it if you would talk us through what this creature is. So can we begin with that? What is it we're talking about when we're dealing with the metaverse?
Sure. Well, the metaverse, actually, I think was originally coined in science fiction. And, it was a concept of like a virtual space where individuals could sort of dive into this virtual reality and then create kind of digital representations of themselves and then run around in this new metaverse. So it's not the universe, it's a metaverse. So it sort of lives in the realm of imagination in a sense. And I think that's one of the reasons why science fiction was so fascinated with it in the early days. But, you know, as with many of these innovations that first arose in science fiction or comics or movies, you know, nerds like me eventually devote their lives to making these things become a reality. So, you know, Dick Tracy had his little radio watches, and now we have our Apple watches where we can take phone calls. And, all these different concepts that we had in the old days now are commonplace. You know, Star Trek had, you could speak to the computer and give it commands. And now many of us have Siri or Amazon Echoes on our desk. So I think the metaverse is in this realm. People have been exploring for a long time about how to make the metaverse not only a reality, but a practical reality, a place that people would choose to be. And I think as you alluded to in passing earlier, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has made a big bet renaming Facebook, one of the biggest technology companies in the world, renaming it Meta, and essentially saying he's going to spend the billions required to make this happen. And I think Zuckerberg was an early enthusiast. He invested in some companies that make goggles that are considered somewhat essential to making the metaverse a truly immersive experience. But you know, the other thing about the metaverse that's interesting is it's not a new concept. I mean, it's been around for a long time. I mean, I've been, and I'm a video gamer. I don't know if you play any video games, Ian, but one of the guys I went to even elementary and middle school with, a gentleman named Jason Jones, we programmed computer games together, you know, back in fifth and sixth grade. He eventually went on to become a computer game designer, and he designed a game called Halo, which was a very famous video game that Microsoft included with their original Xbox. And he has gone on now to create some incredibly immersive and rich video games, including one called Destiny, which is what they call an open world game. And for those of us who played these video games, particularly these modern iterations of video games, I mean, many of us remember Pac-Man and Space Invaders. Yep. You know, it was very 2D, you know, sort of Mario jumping around on a map. You know, video games are a lot different than that now. Computers have gotten so powerful. These games are incredibly immersive and 3D. And instead of just being kind of a flat sprite, like a little animated thing jumping around on a map, you know, you are inside these rich environments with the grass waving in the wind, and you can hear the leaves rustle, and you can run in any direction. And when they call them open world games, they say that because they truly are open. You're not on a path, you know, yep, where, you know, you have to just go step one, step two, step three. You can go in any direction. You can turn in any direction, run in any direction. So I think the concept of the metaverse within the video gaming world is very well developed. And a lot of the younger generation have spent, you know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of hours in these immersive online environments. And now they're saying, because they're so comfortable with these kind of metaphors and computer graphics are becoming cheaper and easier to access, they're starting to say, well, how can we use these environments for other things? Could we move commerce into these environments? Could we move art? Could we move performance? Could we move entertainment into these environments? And then they're not necessarily locked into one video game where, you know, there are certain characters and there's a certain world. I mean, if you move into a space like Second Life, which was a very popular metaverse environment for many years, you could do anything. You could build a medieval village, or you could build a futuristic sci-fi village, you know, and avatars, which are the representations of individuals in these spaces, they could be anything. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a man or a woman. You could be a giant pink dragon. So, you know, I think one of the things that appeals about the metaverse is sort of the boundlessness of human ingenuity and innovation and creativity, because you're not constrained by any of the requirements of the quote unquote meat world, as people refer to it. The meat world. Yes. Like you and me walking around, we're the meat, you know? And,
yeah, that's not going to make vegans happy, is it?
No, that's true. That's true. But I think vegans would admit that we ourselves are meat. So yes, I mean, it's not that we're trying to consume each other, but you know, there are limitations. The flesh is weak, and you know, to build a giant medieval village that you can walk around in your meat body, well, that may be cost prohibitive, but if you can do it in the metaverse and put on some goggles, well, sky's the limit. You know, you can just create your 3D. And again, as computers have become more powerful, graphics cards have become more powerful, the number of polygons that you can render, the amount of light diffusion that a computer can figure out. I mean, it's almost like some of these video game environments, they feel more real than reality, because it's so immersive. And especially when you put on these goggles, which track the movement of your head, you really can confuse your senses and you think that you are in these spaces. So people were thinking about this back in the 80s. It's just our technology was primitive. And as the technology has gotten more powerful, and I think the concept of the metaverse has started to get a lot more traction, because wow, we can realize some of this. I don't doubt that in 10 or 15 years, the technologies and the graphics quality that we have now will be considered hopelessly primitive and retro. So who knows what awaits us around the corner with quantum computing and who knows what else, but Facebook, but now other companies like Apple is rumored to be releasing a set of virtual reality goggles. Microsoft has a set of goggles which works slightly differently, but again, all the same kind of concept. So it might be that there's a book called Ready Player One that talks about sort of a metaverse based future. Maybe we are headed in that direction. But again, because these aren't new concepts, I think we are at a point on that journey and we're headed in one direction, but it's still an open question how long it's going to take before the metaverse reaches the point of ubiquity that I think its enthusiasts would like us to reach.
There's a couple of questions I'm going to flag that I'd like to come back to. So if you can try and remember these as well.
Sure.
But if we can sort of come back to close on questions about any reservations you have about this. And also, because the whole access to justice field, which is our background, is about inclusiveness and ensuring access.
Right.
The depth of technology here may be exclusive or excluding rather than inclusive. So we may come, I'd like to flag those to come back to as kind of issues at the end. But several of the things that you've discussed bring to mind around the dinner table conversation my wife and I had with our two younger grandchildren, aged 10 and 12, just a couple of weekends ago. They were staying with us. And their conversation was wholly about the created world of Minecraft.
Right, right.
For them, that was their reality. And we tried to engage them in conversation about what was going on right in front of us. But it was just to no avail. There, it's another reality. And reality is a word that you used at the outset in your description about creating this reality of this metaverse world. But we're using reality in a couple of different ways, aren't we? It's the reality of the new technology, but it's not reality. It's, there was the quasi-reality of Second Life. Now, is Second Life still around? I don't know.
It is. Yes, it is. And they've tried to make the pivot to virtual reality. But this is another example. I mean, Ethan and I went to Linden Labs, which is the organization that makes Second Life. I mean, this is back in 2006.
Yep.
And, we were talking about, how we're going to resolve disputes in Second Life. Because I think the creators of Second Life had a remarkably open source orientation with the way that they wanted to run that community. So again, none of these lessons are new. I just think that, that as technology advances, it opens up new possibilities and things that before were kind of clunky suddenly become, this is worthy of reconsideration. But I do want to touch on Minecraft, which I think is a very, very interesting example, because much like in the early days of ODR, the assumption was that the optimal way to resolve a dispute was face-to-face.
Sure.
And the presumption was that all ODR was going to attempt to replicate that face-to-face experience. So the question, the vision was, we'll get video conferencing, which at the time was very slow and blocky and clunky, but over time it would get better and better. And that would be the trajectory of ODR. And actually what happened was we started to experiment with other means of interaction between people. And we found that individuals liked to triage their conversations into different communication modes based on the type of discussion or the type of relationship that was involved. So for instance, at eBay, when we built the ODR system, it was all text-based and you didn't see the video of the other side. And while I was at eBay, we bought a company called Skype, which at the time was the most advanced, video interaction platform. And the assumption was, we can use Skype and then people can interact via video to resolve their disputes. And we found that nobody at eBay wanted to do that because eBay wasn't a video interaction platform. It was asynchronous. You logged into the marketplace, you bid on an item, you won your item, you paid for your item. If a problem arose, all of the interaction between the users were based on text and you never saw a picture of your transaction partner. You didn't know their race. You didn't know their age. You didn't know their sex. You didn't know if English was their first language or their second language or their third language. So on eBay, that was the way that people interacted. That was the default mode. And when a dispute arose, people expected to resolve the dispute in the same type of interaction that they used where the dispute arose. So nobody actually used Skype. When eBay bought it, they tried to put it into all the dispute resolution processes. And we put links on everybody's profiles and here you can Skype, but nobody wanted to use it because I think there's an intimacy to video conferencing that that was a mismatch with the eBay marketplace at the time. So the thing about Minecraft that I find so interesting is it really is one of the most successful examples of the metaverse, of sort of a virtual reality, an immersive virtual reality. Now, you can use goggles within Minecraft, but you know, 99% of people don't. And for those who don't know what Minecraft is, it's sort of a Lego type world.
Right.
I mean, when you log into it, everything in the world is very blocky. So there you can land on an island in the middle of an ocean, a virtual island. It doesn't exist anywhere except in your computer. And it's all made up of these different blocks. So maybe you'd have a block that would be dirt, and you'd have a block that would be water. And even you, your character, is very blocky. So The presumption might be that the metaverse is aspiring to replicate the quote unquote meat world reality as closely as possible. But I think Minecraft is an evidence that we're going to create many different realities. And the reason why Minecraft, I think, is so attractive, and it was, I think it really was dominated, it's become dominated by younger people, is it's so easy to be creative in Minecraft because you can build things with these blocks. You can make yourself a castle. You can, you know, dig holes through the earth. You can, you know, and all these blocks, they can have different properties. And when you combine the blocks, maybe you make some gold, or maybe you make some, you know, hay, or all these different things. And it just really opened up the creativity of the space in a way that a more, you know, detailed, quote unquote, accurate representation of face-to-face reality, it would be way too complicated to try and build a castle in that kind of, but in Minecraft, it's really easy because you're just putting blocks together and stacking them all up. So it might be, again, that the very existence of these technologies is going to redefine, you know, what sorts of realities we want to be in. And I think that's just like the assumptions that we made in the early days of ODR were scuttled once we got our hands on the actual technology. I think that we're seeing that as well with the metaverse.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's, for me, there's kind of ironic juxtaposition or opposition going on as well, because I think of some of the other reading I do when I'm not reading about ODR or now starting to read about the metaverse. I'm reading about the importance of connection with nature, of being in nature, for well-being is important to be out there in the trees and walking on the beach.
Sure.
And there's two very different worlds going on. It's not to say that it's one or the other, but it's just the world that you're describing is a wholly created world. It is a virtual world, isn't it?
Right.
And so it's a created world. And yeah, I guess the valuable thing that I'm learning from this is that there's two things, I think. One is on the dispute resolution front. If I take the long view of the kind of legal history of dispute resolution,
sure,
we've constantly changed from, you know, the king and his retinue on horseback going around the counties with his exchequer and collecting money from the peasants and the poor, through to the sophisticated style of courtrooms, through now to modern online techniques. And so in a way, the technology of online dispute resolution is simply another step in that process, isn't it? Which is bound to be resisted by those who are the guardians of the processes that have existed and under which they've flourished up till now. So the way in which the metaverse and the online world is flourishing is merely, if you take an optimistic view, just another step along the way
absolutely.
History.
Yeah, I mean, and if you think throughout history, I think humans have tried to create different realities even before they had a virtual space. I mean, I think about the Sun King at Versailles, you know, sort of building these immaculate gardens and this luxe palace. And, you know, paintings all over the walls and everyone dressing in these costumes. I mean, that was as close as you could get to making a virtual reality at the time. I mean, certainly outside the walls of Versailles, you know, it could have been a pretty miserable existence on the street just trying to survive. But, you know, I think, again, humans, we've shaped our environments throughout our existence, probably as long as there's been humans. And this is just an extension of that into the digital realm. And yeah. And I absolutely think it's important for people to go outside and breathe the fresh air and get the sun on your skin and, you know, go jump in the ocean and, you know, live your sensory life. But, you know, a lot of us spend an inordinate amount of time sitting in chairs looking at LCD screens and, you know, sort of throwing our consciousness into this new sphere, this kind of virtual space. Yeah. And I think, you know, the metaverse is just an attempt to enrich that space, you know, maybe take it again beyond the browser-based, you know, video-based flat version and turn it into a, you know, a 3D space that we can, you know, further articulate our creativity and our desires. Humans fundamentally haven't really changed that much over the past few thousand years. I think, you know, we still have the same desires, but the technologies we have at our disposal have changed. And that's, I think, what virtual reality is a product of.
For sure. I mean, we wouldn't be arguing against combine harvesters and well, I guess these days we might be arguing against motor vehicles, but we've constantly developed technology which has facilitated our other developments in many ways. But can I ask you, you know, one of the questions I alluded to earlier, it was a two-part question, really. The technology, you know, you and I sitting here facing screens and you on the west coast of the USA and I'm in Wellington, and talking through this magnificent technology, what do we know at this stage of the environmental impact of the use of this particular technology? Because it's not carbon neutral, is it?
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, obviously there are green impacts to all of the technologies that we use. The environmental costs of manufacturing all of this technology and putting it in people's hands, the environmental cost of the electricity required to make it go. You know, they talk about, you know, virtual currencies and people mining Bitcoins and how, you know, the energy required to run all of those computers to generate all those ones and zeros and do all that mathematic calculation. I mean, it's the equivalent of the power consumption of moderately sized countries. So
I think,
you know,
Norway was the example typically used, isn't it?
That's right.
As a parallel, yeah.
Yeah, although I think a lot of these, you know, ISPs, these internet companies are locating their computers in places where hopefully the power is greener and cheaper, you know, so they're putting them in rural, you know, Canada where they can use geothermal energy, or they're putting them next to waterfalls, you know, because these things can be located anywhere. So, you know, that's not necessarily true in the face-to-face world. You know, you may have a city that's located far away from the energy sources. So that's a challenge, is producing enough that you can get it to the place where it's needed. But I think that is something to consider. Now, that said, so much of our impact on the planet comes from us just trying to get around. You know, I think I did a greenhouse gas calculator a few years ago. And it said, you know, okay, well, let's see how much, you know, carbon you're responsible for putting in the atmosphere on a yearly basis. So it asked me about the size of my house, and it asked me about my car, and I use solar in my house, and I have drive an electric car, and I'm a vegan. So, you know, all these things, I'm doing pretty well. I'm really proud of the fact that I have very, and then it said, well, how many international flights do you take a year? And this is before the pandemic. Yeah. Right. And I said, oh, well, you know, I probably take five to eight international flights, and wow, my carbon, it like literally 10x'd my carbon, you know. And you know how many, doesn't take that much time. It probably only takes 20 days of accumulated time a year, but they said that is incredibly emitting to get in this giant metal bird and fly up in the atmosphere and then burn all of that fuel to get me to Japan or Chile or wherever I'm going. So again, this whole notion of moving things around, moving around people, moving around cargo, moving around animals, moving all of that, that's a huge, huge contributor in terms of, you know, carbon emissions. So I think one of the things, the optimism of the internet, and I think Zoom achieves this, just like we're using Zoom to record our podcast here. But, you know, if the metaverse could be an opportunity for us to interact in rich ways, that can deliver much of the benefit of face-to-face interaction, well, then that might displace a lot of those international flights. And if I could cut my international flights down from 10 a year to 5, well, that's a pretty big greening of my, you know, presuming I'm not losing any quality in terms of the interaction that I have with the others that I'm interacting with. So, you know, again, I think the metaverse experience now is still a little jerky, a little blocky. It feels kind of like a computer game. It feels a little cartoony. Mm-hmm. But as the technology gets better, I mean, maybe it will be able to replicate the experience of sitting at a table across from a good friend and you know, seeing them up close and having that connection. I don't know. We'll have to see where it goes. But my optimism is that the technology is going to find a way for us to be better stewards of the planet and maybe, sure, you know, make our footsteps a little less destructive because they'll be virtual.
And in many ways, the pandemic did that for us too, because I'm aware that once we locked down at the beginning of 2020,
right,
that was the first time since 2007 that I hadn't taken at least one flight, possibly two.
Same with me.
Either Singapore or New Zealand to Europe. And while I was living in Singapore, probably five return flights between Singapore and New Zealand, as well as at least one from Singapore to Europe. So being locked down would make Greta Thunberg very happy. And doing things this way, well, the international mediation competition held in Paris moved online.
Right.
And what that did also, well, it kept the competition going, but also meant that a whole generation of students, or at least two or three years of a generation of students, became familiar suddenly and of necessity with the ways of dealing with dispute resolution online. And bless them, they became experts at it. They already were experts at it, actually.
Well,
very,
right,
very quickly.
Yep. I was about to say, yeah, the youth shall lead them. I mean, they I think many of the younger people have grown up in a world where these types of technologies have been present since birth. So they have a facility with this type of online interaction that you and I, who were born into a world where this didn't exist, you know, we probably will never achieve. So, and I really do think, I mean, I'm on the record for quite a few years saying that I think society is moving online, and I think eventually we're really going to reserve face-to-face interaction for only those people with whom we have an emotional connection. You know, so our friends and our family. You know, pretty much all of our professional interactions are, I think, are going to migrate online. And the quality of video and audio and the immersiveness of all of that is just going to get better and better and better. So I think the metaverse, in a sense, is an extension of that same dynamic. You know, I mean,
interesting. Oh, sorry to interrupt.
Please, no, please, please.
You've heard of the Dunbar number in terms of friends. The ideal number of friends we have and the number of friends you can manage. And I just wonder whether the metaverse will have an impact on who amongst your Dunbar circle of close friends are the ones you actually still want to have dinner with. And then the ones you know, move slightly out of circles and the ones you eventually only have text-based conversations with. So it may have an impact on the way in which we perceive and orient friendship.
I agree. I agree. A lot of what the metaverse is about is kind of fooling our brains, which have evolved over 100,000 years, as you say, to focus on sort of, you know, tribes. Like if you get above 100 people in a crowd, it's just overwhelming. Yep. And one of the things that's interesting about an interface like Facebook is slowly but surely you go through and you click all these friends. I mean, there was a time, I haven't been on Facebook in a couple of years now, but there was a time when I had, you know, 5,000 friends on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a lot of people that slammed the very use of the term friends to describe that. Can one have 5,000 friends? I mean, I didn't even know who a lot of these people were, but they were people I had met at eBay conferences or just traveling the world. And, you know, anybody who said, hey, can I be your Facebook friend? Sure, I'll be your friend. But, you know, the notion of being in a room with 1,000 of the people you're closest to in the world, you know, you can't really have a conversation with those people.
It's not going
to
happen, is it?
Right. Yeah. But it might be that the metaverse, you know, it will open up our desire to participate in conversations with smaller groups, you know, 5 or 10 people, because again, we're having the sense of being in the room together.
Yep.
So we're not going to have a conversation with 1,000 people, because in the metaverse, that would be overwhelming. So maybe it will give us, recreate that sense, as you say, of the intimacy of a dinner party. And, you know, we would do that online instead of having debates about politics in front of, you know, all your high school friends from 20 years ago.
I think even kind of, well, personally important, but quite trivial ways in which we had that parallel when I was still working in Singapore, but Suzanne, my wife, had come back to New Zealand for family reasons because of her aging parents.
Sure.
And we were in contact, certainly text every day, So each of us knew where the other was. I mean, this sounds kind of oppressive, but we knew where we were.
Right.
And we'd be in video contact several times a week. And we made a point at the weekend, because of the five-hour time difference, I would sit down for a beer at midday and Suzanne with a glass of wine at 5 p.m. New Zealand time, and we'd have a glass of a drink together.
I love that. I love that.
That's obviously a nerdy version of together, but it's a way of catching up. And the technology allows that. But can I come back to something I alluded to on this?
Sure.
We could do that. You and I can have this conversation because we have the access to the technology, even though mine's a fairly aging MacBook, to be upgraded shortly, I hope. And Suzanne and I could have these conversations because we had the tablets and the Wi-Fi, and I'm currently running both wireless and Ethernet here, so I've got high-speed fiber. We've got a problem of access, haven't we? The world of which you are speaking requires a $500 headset and all the technology around it. What's your vision 5 or 10 years down the track in terms of ensuring that pretty well anyone has access to whatever's going on in the metaverse, whether it's shopping or a court appearance or catching up with their friends or being at a funeral? In fact, you know, slight aside here, I look out of the window of our apartment, our nearest neighbor is a Samoan Presbyterian church. Mm. And for the last 2 days, there have been the preparations and now the reality of a Samoan funeral. And there's been a lot of gathering around, everyone dressed in black and wearing the beautiful fine mats that they wrap around themselves. That requires them to be there. It's possible, of course, at the same time, inside the church, there is a video video recording for the family back home in Samoa.
That's right.
We've been to virtually 2 or 3 funerals where we couldn't be there, in part because of the pandemic.
Right.
But the technology allowed it. But back to the question, where do you see this going in a few years to allow almost anybody who wants to have access to this technology?
Well, digital divide has been an issue, you know, all the way along with ODR. And I remember in 99, 2000, you know, building dispute resolution flows and then showing them to people, and they would say, well, wait a minute. Well, don't I have to have a computer in order to access this? And I would say, yeah, you do. And they would say, well, only rich people have computers. So aren't you just building a system for rich people? And mm-hmm. at the time, it was pretty hard to argue with that because it's true. A computer cost $2,000 and, you know, you had to get usually it was a modem or a network connection, you know, yep. before we had Wi-Fi. And I think if you think about what's happened over the past 20 years, well, there has been a bit of a democratization of access to technology as things that were previously prohibitively expensive have become cheaper, and mm-hmm. new technologies have been invented that facilitate access. So, you know, I remember my good friend Sanjana Hatatua talking about, you know, mobile is the future. Mm-hmm. And at the time I said, it's such a narrow experience compared to what you get when you're on a full computer. Well, Sanjana was 100% right. And, you know, now the majority of people, when we build ODR systems, the majority of individuals access them over mobile devices, and the mobile devices become much more powerful, much more engaging, and the convenience, they're in your pocket 24/7. It's more practical than sitting at a computer all day. But again, now you look at the metaverse and you look at these VR goggles and things, and they're kind of where technology was back in 2000. I mean, it's expensive. There is no, sure. There's no shortcut for buying this technology. You have to have the headset and the audio, and it's got to be powerful, and it's got to have the screens in front of your eyes. So again, if you use that technology to build a dispute resolution process, aren't you just building a dispute resolution process for rich people? And I think that criticism has similar traction, but based on the experience of the last 20 years, I think we will likely see a democratization of these technologies, and mm-hmm. they'll come down in price, and they'll become more powerful. At the same time, they become more accessible. So a lot of this is not really about where we are today. It's about where we're going. And, I think a lot of the stuff that I've seen in the metaverse is sort of proof of concept kind of things. Uh-huh. I mean, when it comes to goggles. Now, Minecraft is an excellent example. You know, that software was written and released initially as an independent, you know, it was Mojang was this little software company that released it. And you didn't really have to pay that much to get access. It was, you know, 10 or 20 bucks and it was lifetime access, no additional price. And people, you know, coded Minecraft so that you could access it on a tablet. You could access it on a computer. You could access it on a phone. And that's why I think kids liked it too, because once you pay that price, there's nothing else to pay. And now obviously with these new technologies, virtual reality goggles and things, I think people are figuring out a way to access, you know, Minecraft through those devices as well. But, you know, I remember when, Nicholas Negroponte at the MIT Media Lab was trying to come up with the OLPC, one laptop per child project. And they were trying to get the price of these little laptops. They look kind of like toys with hand cranks on the side. They're trying to get it down to 160 bucks a laptop, which, you know, they had some amazing technological advancements to get the price down. Well, little did we realize that not even 10 years later, the government of India would just be handing out Android tablets to students in rural areas because it was cheaper to give them the Android tablet than it is to buy them a textbook. You know, and these kids are charging their laptops at school and going out to their village where they don't have electricity and then using the light from the laptop, you know, to do their homework by. So again, I think, you know, these technologies, it's amazing. Once we understand sort of what technologies reach ubiquity and the global manufacturing sort of sweeps in, it's amazing how quickly what previously were incredibly expensive things can come down in price and access. So I'm not saying, I don't want to just kind of wave away the concern. I think digital divide is a huge concern, and because there's going to be new technologies that are invented down the road. Maybe quantum computers will cost, you know, $10,000 a piece, and then suddenly the rich people have access to, you know, millions of times more computing power than people that don't have as much money. So I think technology can definitely perpetuate these inequities, but I do think that, you know, over time, it gets cheaper and access increases. So the proof of concepts become commonplace, you know, down the road.
And I'm clearly going to have to get you back on again to talk about quantum computing, because that's a term that's around as well.
Oh, but you can find a better expert than me to talk about quantum computing.
And in any event, we're sort of almost close to the our time. But I want to switch back to where I started, saying that there's a strong part of you and your history which has a humanistic and humanitarian concern. When you think about the technology that you've been immersed in for the last two decades at least, there's one question which you and Amy Schmitz addressed in your 2017 book, which is the issue of trust. I'd like to close with your thoughts on this. In this world of virtual reality, where we are representing ourselves through our avatars, where we are at least at arm's length and possibly at continent's length, how do we manage the very human issues of trust?
It's such a rich and deep question, Ian. And I have written and thought about this for a long time. My division at eBay was actually called Trust and Safety. And one of my very good friends, a guy named Larry Friedberg, he was eBay's director of trust. And we sat right next to each other and we spent long, long nights talking about, you know, what is trust? We actually wrote an article, probably 2006, around there, it's talking about sort of trust. Now, we were thinking about it in the e-commerce context, but also thinking writ large about trust online. And the interesting thing about trust is, you know, it's inseparable from the perception of trust. So you can have a website that should be trusted that is not trusted by its users. And then you should have a website that is trusted by its users that should not be trusted, because they don't really know what's going on in the background. And trust is such a fragile thing. I mean, trust in society is essential to the operation of these societies. And I think when, again, as a nerd, I was excited about technology. I was an early adopter of the internet. And there was a lot of sort of optimistic philosophical rambling in the early days of the internet about how the internet was going to be the new printing press, and it was going to usher in a new age of enlightenment. And, you know, I actually studied with a guy named John Perry Barlow at Harvard, who wrote something called the Declaration of Independence in cyberspace, which sort of, you know, embodied a lot of this optimism about what the internet could mean. And I shared a lot of that optimism. But I think if you look at what's happened with the internet, I mean, sadly, the internet is an extremely accurate mirror held up to humanity. So, you know, there's wonderful things on the internet and there's horrible things on the internet.
Yep.
And, you know, I think it's a little bit of a Rorschach test. I mean, people look at the internet and they say, is it good or is it bad? And, you know, if people are skeptical about technology, they say, oh, this is terrible. But, you know, there's many things to say, wow, it's incredible that, you know, what the internet has achieved in terms of creating opportunity for people around the world and, you know, spreading understanding and spreading access to information. I mean, I was in the Peace Corps in Eritrea, and I remember, you know, they had a very small library with a tiny number of books, you know, shared among thousands of kids. And you know, every page was, you know, pored over because it was so difficult to get access to information about the outside world. And now the internet, you know, has the potential of, again, opening up access to all of this information, you know. So I still retain a lot of the idealism about what the promise of the internet might be, but I think it's beyond contention that the internet has also wreaked havoc and, you know, has been utilized by individuals for, you know, their own selfish ends. And it is undermined. And getting back to the question of trust, you know, I think the internet, there are a lot of things maybe that we were told when we were growing up about the way the world works and, you know, what's right and what's wrong. And I think the internet has sort of shown a Klieg light on a lot of those things and highlighted some of their inaccuracies. And I think a society, global society, is now dealing with that. You know, I think maybe we now have clarity. We can see videos of, you know, injustices being done all over the world. And previously we didn't have that visibility. So it might have been easier to live a life where we had that trust that, you know, human rights are respected and the world is a just place. But now, you know, the torrent of information that the internet delivers to us on a daily basis, it can be profoundly destabilizing and disillusioning. So, you know, I think that this disruption, I do think that this is a little bit like lancing a boil. I think over the long run, this is a good thing for us to have this connection, to equalize this opportunity. And I think we're going to learn how to civilize cyberspace and utilize these technologies in a way that reinforce as opposed to undermine our shared civic values. I do think that we're on that path, much like when, you know, in America, they moved west and there were these kind of lawless areas where, you know, people behaved abominably towards each other. But then eventually they brought in the law, they brought in law enforcement, they brought in, you know, things to civilize those spaces. And I think that the internet is a little bit like that. It's like an undiscovered country. And right now it's very chaotic. It's very anarchic. Nobody knows what the rules are, but slowly but surely we're going to figure it out. And we're going to figure out how to create spaces that reinforce our shared values, one of which is trust. And there are a lot of people, not just at eBay. I mean, we were the first division of trust and safety in Silicon Valley. Now all the major internet companies have divisions of trust and safety because they understand how central trust is to everything that they're trying to achieve, be it a commercial purpose or a social purpose. So we're going to get better and better at that. And I think there's always going to be dark corners of the internet where nefarious things happen. But much like at eBay, which at the beginning was just, you know, caveat emptor, buyer beware, it was game on. Anybody can sell anything to anybody. And there was a lot of, you know, sad, terrible things that occurred within that marketplace. Eventually, Meg Whitman and others, leaders at eBay, came in and said, nope, we're going to clean this up. We're going to get the bad stuff off. We're going to run it so that people can trust that when they make a transaction, they're going to be taken care of. We're going to track the reputation of all of the people in the marketplace. We're going to get the bad guys and throw them out. And we're going to have a process for resolving any disputes that arise. You know, those were the three legs of what we called the trust stool. You know, getting the bad guys, fraud investigations, reputation, and resolutions.
Yep.
And I think now we're seeing that spread across the internet. So I agree with you, Ian, trust is central to all human communities. And if we're going to build a community online, we have to figure out how to do it. In the short term, I think we're seeing a big drop in trust as a result of the disruption, but I hope we're going to figure out.
Not just the online world.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. I think the online world is also leading to a drop in trust in the face-to-face world. But, you know, over time, And it may be algorithms. I mean, if you look at Web3, and you know, we talked about quantum computing, we talk about Bitcoin and, you know, decentralized justice, it might be that, you know, publicly auditable algorithms that everybody can look at and say, yes, I trust these algorithms, because, you know, anybody can take a look at them, make sure they're not corrupted. You know, that may be the engine of trust in the future, more so than relying on our fellow humans, you know, which we know the perils of sometimes putting too much trust in others, yes, whose intents and purposes we don't fully understand. So it's a rich question, and I apologize for kind of scattershotting the topic, but
absolutely, no apology necessary. And again, along with quantum computing, trust is something that possibly is worth one or two whole podcast sessions.
But definitely
on that, I guess we're going to need to wrap up, because, you know, you and I could continue this conversation for the next couple of hours, quite happily chatting away, but in the interest of the podcast community and the normal length of a bus ride when people are listening, we should wrap up. Colin, it's just always a treat to catch up with you, and I look forward to, well, listening to this again when it's up online, and of course, further chats that you and I will continue to have. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Ian. And you're going to have to just indulge me to say thank you for doing this podcast, for leading the conversation within iCoder and the ODR community. I could just listen to you all day and all night, and I'm delighted that now I have the excuse to do so through this podcast. So thank you, Ian. And I can't wait to hear your future episodes. And thank you for having me on. It's really been fun.
Thank you. Take care. Over and out.
This podcast has been brought to you by iCoder, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about iCoder or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.